reputation and set him far back on the road to his long-term goal. If he chose not to run, on the other hand, he might wait 10 years for another chance. With all this in mind, he threw caution to the winds and entered the race. Johnson's first step was to call to his side the dozens of young men and women whom he had helped or hired over the years. His campaign strategy was simple. He would separate himself from the other contenders by presenting himself as Roosevelt's staunchest supporter. A vote for Johnson was a vote for the president, the popular architect of the New Deal. And since Johnson could not compete in Austin, he decided to aim his army of volunteers at the countryside, the sparsely populated hill country. This was the district's poorest area, a place where candidates rarely ventured. Johnson wanted to meet every last farmer and sharecropper, shake every possible hand, win the votes of people who had never voted before. It was the strategy of a desperate man who recognized that this was his best and only chance for victory. One of Johnson's most loyal followers was Carol Keach, who would serve as his chauffeur. Together, the two men drove every square mile of the hill country, tracing every dirt path and cow trail. Spotting some out-of-the-way farmhouse, Johnson would get out of the car, walk to the door, introduce himself to the startled inhabitants, listen patiently to their problems, then leave with a hearty handshake and a gentle plea for their vote. Convening meetings in dusty towns consisting mainly of a church and a gas station, he would deliver his speech, then mingle with the audience and spend at least a few minutes with everyone present. He had an incredible memory for faces and names. If he happened to meet the same person twice, he could recall everything he or she had said the first time around, and he often impressed strangers by knowing someone who knew them. He listened intensely and was always careful to leave people with a feeling that they would see him again, and that if he won, they would finally have someone looking out for their interests in Washington. In bars, grocery stores, and gas stations all through the hill country, he would talk with the locals as if he had nothing else to do. On leaving, he would make sure to buy something. Candy, groceries, gasoline. A gesture they greatly appreciated. He had the gift of creating a connection. As the race ran on, Johnson went days without sleep, his voice turning hoarse, his eyes drooping. As Keach drove the length of the district, he would listen in amazement as the exhausted candidate in the car muttered to himself about the people he had just met, the impression he had made, what he could have done better. Johnson never wanted to seem desperate or patronizing. It was that last handshake and look in the eye that mattered. The polls were deceptive. They continued to show Johnson behind, but he knew he had won votes that no poll would register. And in any case, he was slowly catching up. By the last week, he had crept into third place. Now, suddenly, the other candidates took notice. The election turned nasty. Johnson was attacked for his youth, for his blind support of Roosevelt, for anything that could be dug up. Trying to win a few votes in Austin, Johnson came up against the political machine of Mayor Miller, who disliked him and did everything possible to sabotage his campaign. Undeterred, Johnson personally visited the mayor several times in that last week to broker some kind of truce. But Miller saw through his charm. His personal appeal might have won over the district's poorest voters, but the other candidate saw a different side of him. He was ruthless and capable of slinging mud. As he rose in the polls, he made more and more enemies. On election day, Johnson pulled off one of the greatest upsets in American political history, outdistancing his nearest rival by 3,000 votes. Exhausted by the grueling pace he had set, he was hospitalized. But the day after his victory, he was back at work. He had something extremely important to do. From his hospital bed, Johnson dictated letters to his rivals in the race. He congratulated them for running a great campaign. He also described his own victory as a fluke, a vote for Roosevelt more than for himself. Learning that Miller was visiting Washington, Johnson telegraphed his connections in the city to chaperone the mayor and treat him like royalty. As soon as Johnson left the hospital, he paid visits to his rivals and acted with almost embarrassing humility. He even befriended Polk's brother, driving him around town to run errands. A mere 18 months later, Johnson had to stand for re-election, and these one-time opponents and bitter enemies suddenly turned into the most fervent Johnson believers, donating money, even campaigning on his behalf. And Mayor Miller, the one man who had hated Johnson the most, now became his strongest supporter and remained so for years to come. Interpretation. For most of us, the conclusion of anything, a project, a campaign, an attempt at persuasion, represents a kind of wall. Our work is done, and it is time to tally our gains and losses and move on. Lyndon Johnson looked at the world much differently. An ending was not like a wall, but more like a door, leading to the next phase or battle. What mattered to him was not gaining a victory, but where it left him, how it opened onto the next round. What good would it do to win the election of 1937 if he were thrown out of office 18 months later? That would be a devastating setback to his dream of the presidency. If, after the election, he had basked in his moment of triumph, he would have sown the seeds of failure in the next election. He had made too many enemies. If they didn't run against him in 1938, they would stir up trouble while he was away in Washington. So Johnson immediately worked to win these men over, whether with charm, with meaningful gestures, or with clever appeals to their self-interest. He kept his eye on the future and on the kind of success that would keep him moving forward. Johnson used the same approach in his efforts to win over voters. Instead of trying to persuade people to support him with speeches and fancy words, he was not a good orator anyway, he focused on the feeling he left people with. He knew that persuasion is ultimately a process of the emotions. Words can sound nice, but if a politician leaves people suspecting him of being insincere, of merely plugging for votes, they will close off to him and forget him. So Johnson worked to establish an emotional connection with voters, and he would close his conversations with them with a hearty handshake and with a look in his eye, a tremor in his voice, that sealed the bond between them. He left them feeling that they would see him again, and he stirred emotions that would erase any suspicion he might be insincere. The end of the conversation was in fact a kind of beginning, for it stayed in their minds and translated into votes. Understand, in any venture, your tendency to think in terms of winning or losing, success or failure, is dangerous. Your mind comes to a stop instead of looking ahead. Emotions dominate the moment. A smug elation in winning, dejection and bitterness in losing. What you need is a more fluid and strategic outlook on life. Nothing ever really ends. How you finish something will influence and even determine what you do next. Some victories are negative. They lead nowhere. And some defeats are positive, working as a wake-up call or lesson. This fluid kind of thinking will force you to put more strategic emphasis on the quality and mood of the ending. It will make you look at your opponents and decide whether you might do better to be generous to them at the end, taking a step back and transforming them into allies, playing on the emotions of the moment. Keeping your eyes on the aftermath of any encounter, you will think more of the feeling you leave people with, a feeling that might translate into a desire to see more of you. By understanding that any victory or defeat is temporary, and that what matters is what you do with them, you will find it easier to keep yourself balanced during the thousands of battles that life entails. The only real ending is death. Everything else is a transition. From Hagakure, The Book of the Samurai, by Yamamoto Tsunetomo. As Yasuda Ukyo said about offering up the last wine cup, only the end of things is important. One's whole life should be like this. When guests are leaving, the mood of being reluctant to say farewell is essential. Keys to Warfare. There are three kinds of people in the world. First, there are the dreamers and talkers, who begin their projects with a burst of enthusiasm, but this burst of energy quickly peters out as they encounter the real world and the hard work needed to bring any project to an end. They are emotional creatures who live mainly in the moment. They easily lose interest as something new grabs their attention. Their lives are littered with half-finished projects, including some that barely make it beyond a daydream. Then there are those who bring whatever they do to a conclusion, either because they have to or because they can manage the effort. But they cross the finish line with distinctly less enthusiasm and energy than they had starting out. This mars the end of the campaign. Because they are impatient to finish, the ending seems hurried and patched together, and it leaves other people feeling slightly unsatisfied. It is not memorable, does not last, has no resonance. Both of these types begin each project without a firm idea of how to end it. And as the project progresses, inevitably differing from what they had imagined it would be, they become unsure how to get out of it, and either give up or simply rush to the end. The third group comprises those who understand a primary law of power and strategy. The end of something, a project, a campaign, a conversation, has inordinate importance for people. It resonates in the mind. A war can begin with great fanfare and can bring many victories, but if it ends badly, that is all anyone remembers. Knowing the importance and the emotional resonance of the ending of anything, people of the third type understand that the issue is not simply finishing what they have started, but finishing it well, with energy, a clear head, and an eye on the afterglow, the way the event will linger in people's minds. These types invariably begin with a clear plan. When setbacks come, as setbacks will, they are able to stay patient and think rationally. They plan not just to the end, but past it, to the aftermath. These are the ones who create things that last. A meaningful piece, a memorable work of art, a long and fruitful career. The reason it is hard to end things well is simple. Endings inspire overpowering emotions. At the end of a bitter conflict, we have a deep desire for peace, an impatience for the truce. If the conflict is bringing us victory, we often succumb to delusions of grandeur, or are swept by greed and grab for more than we need. If the conflict has been nasty, anger moves us to finish with a violent, punitive strike. If we lose, we are left with a burning desire for revenge. Emotions like these can ruin all of our prior good work. There is, in fact, nothing harder in the realm of strategy than keeping our head on straight all the way to the end and past the end. Yet nothing is more necessary. Napoleon Bonaparte was perhaps the greatest general that ever lived. His strategies were marvels of combined flexibility and detail, and he planned all the way to the end. But after defeating the Austrians at Austerlitz, and then the Prussians at Jena-Auerstedt, his two greatest victories, he imposed on these nations harsh terms, intended to make them weakened satellites of France. Accordingly, in the years after the treaties, both countries harbored a powerful desire for revenge. They secretly built up their armies and waited for the day when Napoleon would be vulnerable. That moment came after his disastrous retreat from Russia in 1812, when they pounced on him with horrible fervor. Napoleon had allowed petty emotion, the desire to humiliate, revenge himself, and force obedience, to infect his strategy. Had he stayed focused on his long-term interests, he would have known that it was better to weaken Prussia and Austria psychologically rather than physically, to seduce them with apparently generous terms, transforming them into devoted allies instead of resentful satellites. Many in Prussia had initially seen Napoleon as a great liberator. Had he only kept Prussia as a happy ally, he would have survived the debacle in Russia, and there would have been no Waterloo. Learn the lesson well. Brilliant plans and piled-up conquests are not enough. You can become the victim of your own success, letting victory seduce you into going too far, creating hard-bitten enemies, winning the battle, but losing the political game after it. What you need is a strategic third eye. The ability to stay focused on the future while operating in the present and ending your actions in a way that will serve your interests for the next round of war. This third eye will help you counteract the emotions that can insidiously infect your clever strategies, particularly anger and the desire for revenge. The critical question in war is knowing when to stop, when to make your exit and come to terms. Stop too soon, and you lose whatever you might have gained by advancing. You allow too little time for the conflict to show you where it is heading. Stop too late, and you sacrifice your gains by exhausting yourself, grabbing more than you can handle, creating an angry and vengeful enemy. The great philosopher of war, Karl von Clausewitz, analyzed this problem, discussing what he called the culminating point of victory, the optimum moment to end the war. To recognize the culminating point of victory, you must know your own resources, how much you can handle, the morale of your soldiers, any signs of a slackening effort. Fail to recognize that moment, keep fighting past it, and you bring on yourself all kinds of unwanted consequences. Exhaustion, escalating cycles of violence, and worse. At the turn of the 20th century, the Japanese watched as Russia made advances into China and Korea. In 1904, hoping to stem Russian expansion, they launched a surprise attack on the Russian-held town of Port Arthur, on the coast of Manchuria. Since they were clearly the smaller country and had fewer military resources, they hoped that a quick offensive would work in their favor. The strategy, the brainchild of Baron Gentaro Kodama, vice chief of Japan's general staff, was effective. By stealing the initiative, the Japanese were able to bottle up the Russian fleet at Port Arthur while they landed armies in Korea. That allowed them to defeat the Russians in key battles on land and at sea. Momentum was clearly on their side. In April 1905, however, Kodama began to see great danger in his own success. Japan's manpower and resources were limited. Russia's were vast. Kodama convinced the Japanese leaders to consolidate the gains they had made and sue for peace. The Treaty of Portsmouth, signed later that year, granted Russia more than generous terms, but Japan solidified its position. The Russians moved out of Manchuria and Korea and left Port Arthur to Japan. Had the Japanese been carried along by their momentum, they would surely have passed the culminating point of victory and had all their gains wiped out by the inevitable counterattack. On the other side of the scale, the Americans ended the Gulf War of 1991 too soon, allowing much of the Iraqi army to escape its encirclement. That left Saddam Hussein still strong enough to brutally put down the Shiite and Kurdish uprisings that erupted after his defeat in Kuwait and to hang on to power. The Allied forces were held back from completing the victory by their desire not to appear to be beating up on an Arab nation and by the fear of a power vacuum in Iraq. Their failure to finish led to far greater violence in the long run. Imagine that everything you do has a moment of perfection and fruition. Your goal is to end your project there, at such a peak. Succumb to tiredness, boredom, or impatience for the end, and you fall short of that peak. Greed and delusions of grandeur will make you go too far. To conclude at this moment of perfection, you must have the clearest possible sense of your goals, of what you really want. You must also command an in-depth knowledge of your resources. How far can you practicably go? This kind of awareness will give you an intuitive feel for the culminating point. Endings in purely social relationships demand a sense of the culminating point as much as those in war. A conversation or story that goes on too long always ends badly. Overstaying your welcome, boring people with your presence, is the deepest failing. You should leave them wanting more of you, not less. You can accomplish this by bringing the conversation or encounter to an end a moment before the other side expects it. Leave too soon, and you may seem timid or rude. But do your departure right at the peak of enjoyment and liveliness, the culminating point, and you create a devastatingly positive afterglow. People will still be thinking of you long after you are gone. In general, it is always best to end with energy and flair on a high note. Victory and defeat are what you make of them. It is how you deal with them that matters. Since defeat is inevitable in life, you must master the art of losing well and strategically. First, think of your own mental outlook, how you absorb defeat psychologically. See it as a temporary setback, something to wake you up and teach you a lesson. And even as you lose, you end on a high note and with an edge. You are mentally prepared to go on the offensive in the next round. So often, those who have success become soft and imprudent. You must welcome defeat as a way to make yourself stronger. Second, you must see any defeat as a way to demonstrate something positive about yourself and your character to other people. This means standing tall, not showing signs of bitterness or becoming defensive. Early in his term as president, John F. Kennedy embroiled the country in the Bay of Pigs fiasco, a failed invasion of Cuba. While he accepted full responsibility for the debacle, he did not overdo his apologies. Instead, he went to work on correcting the mistake, making sure it would not happen again. He kept his composure, showing remorse, but also strength. In doing so, he won public and political support that helped him immensely in his future fights. Third, if you see that defeat is inevitable, it is often best to go down swinging. That way you end on a high note even as you lose. This helps to rally the troops, giving them hope for the future. At the Battle of the Alamo in 1836, every last American fighting the Mexican army died. But they died heroically, refusing to surrender. The battle became a rallying cry, "Remember the Alamo," and an inspired American force under Sam Houston finally defeated the Mexicans for good. You do not have to experience physical martyrdom, but a display of heroism and energy makes defeat into a moral victory that will soon enough translate into a concrete one. Planting the seeds of future victory in present defeat is strategic brilliance of the highest order. Finally, since any ending is a kind of beginning of the next phase, it is often wise strategy to end on an ambivalent note. If you are reconciling with an enemy after a fight, subtly hint that you still have a residue of doubt, that the other side must still prove itself to you. When a campaign or project comes to an end, leave people feeling that they cannot foresee what you will do next. Keep them in suspense, toying with their attention. By ending on a note of mystery and ambiguity, a mixed signal, an insinuating comment, a touch of doubt, you gain the upper hand for the next round in a most subtle and insidious fashion. Reversal. There can be no value in ending anything badly. There is no reversal. Here are further reflections on the exit strategy. From the I Ching. If one overshoots the goal, one cannot hit it. If a bird will not come to its nest but flies higher and higher, it eventually falls into the hunter's net. He who in times of extraordinary salience of small things does not know how to call a halt, but restlessly seeks to press on and on, draws upon himself misfortune at the hands of gods and men, because he deviates from the order of nature. By Tacitus. They create desolation and call it peace. From All's Well That Ends Well by William Shakespeare. All's well that ends well, still the fine's the crown. Whate'er the course, the end is the renown. From The Great Arab Conquests by John Bagot Glubb. 10,000 Muslims then marched through the mountain valleys upon Mecca. Muhammad divided his force into four columns. Muhammad gave strict orders that no violence was to be used. His own tent was pitched on high ground immediately overlooking the town. 8 years before, he had fled from Mecca under cover of darkness and lain hidden 3 days in a cave on Mount Thor, which from his tent he could now see rising beyond the city. Now 10,000 warriors were ready to obey his least command, and his native town lay helpless at his feet. After a brief rest, he remounted his camel and entered the town, reverently touched the black stone, and performed the 7 ritual circuits of the Kaaba. Muhammad the Conqueror was not vindictive. A general amnesty was proclaimed, from which less than 12 persons were excluded, only 4 being actually executed. Ikrimah, the son of Abu Jahal, escaped to the Yemen, but his wife appealed to the apostle, who agreed to forgive him. The Muslim occupation of Mecca was thus virtually bloodless. The fiery Khalid ibn Walid killed a few people at the southern gate and was sharply reprimanded by Muhammad for doing so. Although the apostle had himself been persecuted in the city, and although many of his bitterest opponents were still living there, he won all hearts by his clemency on his day of triumph. Such generosity, or statesmanship, was particularly remarkable among Arabs, a race to whom revenge has always been dear. His success had been won by policy and diplomacy rather than by military action. In an age of violence and bloodshed, he had realized that ideas are more powerful than force. By Ovid. Either don't attempt it, or carry it through to the end. From Strategy, by B.H. Little Hart. Indeed, deepening study of past experience leads to the conclusion that nations might often have come nearer to their object by taking advantage of a lull in the struggle to discuss a settlement than by pursuing the war with the aim of victory. History reveals also that in many cases a beneficial peace could have been obtained if the statesmen of the warring nations had shown more understanding of the elements of psychology in their peace feelers. Their attitude has commonly been too akin to that seen in the typical domestic quarrel. Each party is afraid to appear yielding, with the result that when one of them shows any inclination toward conciliation, this is usually expressed in language that is too stiff, while the other is apt to be slow to respond, partly from pride or obstinacy, and partly from a tendency to interpret such a gesture as a sign of weakening, when it may be a sign of returning common sense. Thus, the fateful moment passes, and conflict continues, to the common damage. Rarely does a continuation serve any good purpose where the two parties are bound to go on living under the same roof. This applies even more to modern war than to domestic conflict, since the industrialization of nations has made their fortunes inseparable. From Strategy, by B.H. Little Hart. If you concentrate exclusively on victory, with no thought for the after effect, you may be too exhausted to profit by the peace, while it is almost certain that the peace will be a bad one, containing the germs of another war. This is a lesson supported by abundant experience. From On War, by Karl von Clausewitz. It is even possible that the attacker, reinforced by the psychological forces peculiar to attack, will, in spite of his exhaustion, find it less difficult to go on than to stop, like a horse pulling a load uphill. We believe that this demonstrates, without inconsistency, how an attacker can overshoot the point at which, if he stopped and assumed the defensive, there would still be a chance of success, that is, of equilibrium. It is therefore important to calculate this point correctly when planning the campaign. An attacker may otherwise take on more than he can manage, and as it were get into debt. A defender must be able to recognize this error if the enemy commits it, and exploit it to the full. In reviewing the whole array of factors a general must weigh before making his decision, we must remember that he can gauge the direction and value of the most important ones only by considering numerous other possibilities, some immediate some remote. He must guess, so to speak. Guess whether the first shock of battle will steel the enemy's resolve and stiffen his resistance, or whether, like a Bologna flask, it will shatter as soon as its surface is scratched. Guess the extent of debilitation and paralysis that the drying up of the particular sources of supply and the severing of certain lines of communication will cause in the enemy. Guess whether the burning pain of the injury he has been dealt will make the enemy collapse with exhaustion, or, like a wounded bull, arouse his rage. Guess whether the other powers will be frightened or indignant, and whether and which political alliances will be dissolved or formed. When we realize that he must hit upon all this and much more by means of his discreet judgment, as a marksman hits a target, we must admit that such an accomplishment of the human mind is no small achievement. Thousands of wrong turns running in all directions tempt his perception. And if the range, confusion, and complexity of the issues are not enough to overwhelm him, the dangers and responsibilities may. This is why the great majority of generals will prefer to stop well short of their objective rather than risk approaching it too closely, and why those with high courage and an enterprising spirit will often overshoot it and so fail to attain their purpose. Only the man who can achieve great results with limited means has really hit the mark. From The Mind of War by Grant T. Hammond. The great prize fighter Jack Dempsey was once asked, "When you are about to hit a man, do you aim for his chin or his nose?" "Neither," Dempsey replied. "I aim for the back of his head." From the I Ching. Victory seems to have been achieved. There remains merely a remnant of the evil, resolutely to be eradicated as the time demands. Everything looks easy. Just there, however, lies the danger. If we are not on guard, evil will succeed in escaping by means of concealment, and when it has eluded us, new misfortunes will develop from the remaining seeds, for evil does not die easily. From The General's War, The Inside Story of the Conflict in the Gulf, by Michael R. Gordon and General Bernard E. Traynor. CENTCOM's lightning war, Desert Storm, was over. It had been billed as a 100-hour blitz, but 3 years later it was still an unfinished war. Recalled Gordon Brown, the foreign service officer who served as Schwarzkopf's chief foreign policy advisor at CENTCOM, "We never did have a plan to terminate the war." And lastly, from The Gay Science, by Friedrich Nietzsche. Knowing how to end. Masters of the first rank are recognized by the fact that in matters great and small, they know how to find an end perfectly, be it at the end of a melody or a thought, of a tragedy's fifth act or an act of state. The best of the second rank always get restless toward the end, and do not fall into the sea with such proud and calm balance as do, for example, the mountains at Portofino, where the Bay of Genoa finishes its melody. Part 5. Unconventional, Dirty Warfare. A general fighting a war must constantly search for an advantage over the opponent. The greatest advantage comes from the element of surprise, from hitting enemies with strategies that are novel, outside their experience, completely unconventional. It is in the nature of war, however, that over time, any strategy with any possible application will be tried and tested so that the search for the new and unconventional has an innate tendency to become more and more extreme. At the same time, moral and ethical codes that governed warfare for centuries have gradually loosened. These two effects dovetail into what we today call dirty war, where anything goes, down to the killing of thousands of unwarned civilians. Dirty war is political, deceptive, and supremely manipulative. Often the last recourse of the weak and desperate, it uses any means available to level the playing field. The dynamic of the dirty has filtered into society and the culture at large, whether in politics, business, or society. The way to defeat your opponents is to surprise them, to come at them from an unexpected angle. And the increasing pressures of these daily wars make dirty strategies inevitable. People go underground. They seem nice and decent, but use slippery, devious methods behind the scenes. The unconventional has its own logic that you must understand. First, nothing stays new for long. Those who depend on novelty must constantly come up with some fresh idea that goes against the orthodoxies of the time. Second, people who use unconventional methods are very hard to fight. The classic direct route, the use of force and strength, does not work. You must use indirect methods to combat indirection. Fight fire with fire, even at the cost of going dirty yourself. To try to stay clean out of a sense of morality is to risk defeat. The chapters in this section will initiate you into the various forms of the unorthodox. Some of these are strictly unconventional, deceiving your opponents and working against their expectations. Others are more political and slippery, making morality a strategic weapon, applying the arts of guerrilla warfare to daily life, mastering the insidious forms of passive aggression. And some are unapologetically dirty, destroying the enemy from within, inflicting terror and panic. These chapters are designed to give you a greater understanding of the diabolical psychology involved in each strategy, helping to arm you with the proper defense. Chapter 23. Weave a seamless blend of fact and fiction. Misperception strategies. Since no creature can survive without the ability to see or sense what is going on around it, you must make it hard for your enemies to know what is going on around them, including what you are doing. Disturb their focus and you weaken their strategic powers. People's perceptions are filtered through their emotions. They tend to interpret the world according to what they want to see. Feed their expectations. Manufacture a reality to match their desires, and they will fool themselves. The best deceptions are based on ambiguity, mixing fact and fiction so that the one cannot be disentangled from the other. Control people's perceptions of reality, and you control them. The False Mirror. On November 3, 1943, Adolf Hitler had a document distributed to his top generals, Directive 51, which discussed his conviction that the Allies would invade France the following year and explained how to beat them. For years, Hitler had depended on a kind of intuition in making his most important strategic decisions, and time and again his instincts had been right. The Allies had tried before to make him believe that an invasion of France was imminent, but each time Hitler had seen through the deception. This time, he was not only sure that the invasion was coming, he felt he knew exactly where it would come. The Pas-de-Calais, the region of France along the English Channel, that was the country's closest point to Britain. The Pas-de-Calais had a number of major ports, and the Allies would need a port to land their troops. The region was also where Hitler planned to place his V-1 and V-2 rockets, soon to be operational. With these jet-propelled, unmanned missiles so close to London, he could bomb Britain into submission. The English knew he was putting missiles there, and that provided them yet another reason to invade France at the Pas-de-Calais before Hitler could begin his bombing campaign. In Directive 51, Hitler warned his commanders to expect the Allies to wage a major deception campaign to cloak the time and place of the invasion. The Germans had to see through these deceptions and repel the landing. And despite recent setbacks in the German war effort, Hitler felt supremely confident they could. Several years earlier, he had commissioned the construction of the Atlantic Wall, a line of forts up and down the coast from France to Norway, and he had over 10 million soldiers at his disposal, 1 million of them in France alone. The German armaments industry was churning out ever more and better weapons. Hitler also controlled most of Europe, giving him enormous resources and endless options for moving his troops here and there. Finally, to invade France, the Allies would need a massive armada, which, once assembled, would be impossible to conceal. Hitler had infiltrated agents into all levels of the British military who supplied him with excellent intelligence. They would forward to him the time and location of the invasion. The Allies would not surprise him. And once he had defeated them on the shores of France, England would have to sue for peace. Roosevelt would certainly lose the upcoming U.S. presidential election. Hitler could then concentrate his entire army against the Soviet Union and finally defeat it. In truth, the invasion of France was the opportunity he craved to turn the war around. Hitler's commander in Western Europe was Field Marshal Gerd von Rundstedt, Germany's most respected general. To further solidify the defensive position in France, Hitler made General Erwin Rommel the commander of the forces along the French coast. Rommel proceeded to make improvements in the Atlantic Wall, turning it into a devil's garden of minefields and fire zones. Rommel and Rundstedt also asked for more troops to ensure that the Germans could repel the Allies at the water's edge. But the Führer denied their request. Hitler had lately come to mistrust his top staff. In the past few years, he had survived several assassination attempts that had clearly originated among his officers. His generals were increasingly arguing with his strategies, and in his mind, they had botched several battles in the Russian campaign. He saw many of them as incompetents or traitors. He began to spend less time with his officers and more time holed up in his Bavarian mountain retreat at Berchtesgaden with his mistress Eva Braun and his beloved dog Blondie. There he pored over maps and intelligence reports, determined to make the important decisions himself and to manage the entire war effort more directly. This caused a change in his way of thinking. Instead of making quick, intuitive choices, he was trying to foresee every possibility and was taking longer to make up his mind. Now he thought Rommel and Rundstedt, in their request for more troops to be transferred to France, were being overly cautious and even panicky. He alone would have to foil the Allied invasion. It was up to him to see through his general's weaknesses and the enemy's deceptions. The only downside to this was that his workload had increased tenfold, and he was more tired than ever. At night, he took sleeping pills. By day, whatever he could get his hands on to keep him alert. Early in 1944, key information arrived in Hitler's hands. A German agent in Turkey stole classified documents confirming that the Allies would invade France that year. The documents also indicated plans for an imminent invasion of the Balkans. Hitler was particularly sensitive to any threats to the Balkans, a valuable source of resources for Germany. A loss there would be devastating. The threat of such an attack made it impossible to transfer troops from there to France. Hitler's agents in England also discovered plans to invade Norway, and here Hitler actually reinforced his troops to ward off the threat. By April, as Hitler pored over intelligence reports, he began to feel increasingly excited. He discerned a pattern in the enemy activity. As he had thought, everything pointed toward an invasion of the Pas-de-Calais. One sign particularly stood out, indications of an enormous army forming in southeastern England under the command of General George Patton. This army, called FUSAG, First United States Army Group, was clearly positioned for a crossing to the Pas-de-Calais. Of all the Allies' generals, Hitler feared Patton the most. He had proven his military skill in North Africa and Sicily. He would be the perfect commander for the invasion. Hitler demanded more information on Patton's army. High-flying reconnaissance planes photographed enormous military camps, docking equipment, thousands of tanks moving through the countryside, a pipeline being built to the coast. When a captured German general who had been imprisoned in England was finally repatriated, he caught glimpses of massive activity in the FUSAG area on his trip from his internment camp to London. Agents in Switzerland reported that every map of the Pas-de-Calais area had been mysteriously bought up. The pieces of a giant puzzle were coming together. Now only one question remained. When would it happen? As April turned to May, Hitler was deluged with all kinds of conflicting reports, rumors, and sightings. The information was confusing, taxing his strained mind, but two nuggets of intelligence seemed to clarify the picture. First, a German agent in England reported that the Allies would attack Normandy, southeast of the Pas-de-Calais, between June 5th and 7th. But the Germans had strong indications that this man was operating as a double agent, and his report was clearly part of an Allied disinformation campaign. The attack would probably be coming at the end of June or beginning of July, when the weather was generally more predictable. Then, later in May, a series of more reliable German spies spotted Britain's top general, Sir Bernard Montgomery, in Gibraltar and then in Algiers. Montgomery would certainly command a large part of any invading force. The invasion could not be imminent if he was so far away. On the night of June 5th, Hitler pored over the maps. Maybe he was wrong. Maybe the plan was for Normandy all along. He had to consider both options. He would not be fooled in what might be the most decisive battle of his life. The British were tricky. He had to keep his forces mobile, in case it was Normandy after all. He would not commit himself until he knew for sure. Reading the weather reports for the Channel, stormy that evening, he took his usual sleeping pill and went to bed. Early next morning, Hitler woke to startling news. A massive invasion was underway in southern Normandy. A large armada had left England in the middle of the night, and hundreds of parachutists had been dropped near the Normandy coast. As the day progressed, the reports became more exact. The Allies had landed on the beaches southeast of Cherbourg. A critical moment had come. If some of the forces stationed in the Pas-de-Calais were hurried to the beaches of Normandy, the Allies could be pinned and thrown back into the sea. This was the recommendation of Rommel and Rundstedt, who anxiously awaited Hitler's approval. But through the night and into the following day, Hitler hesitated. Then, just as he was on the verge of sending reinforcements to Normandy, he received word of increased Allied activity in the Fusag area. Was Normandy, in fact, a giant diversion? If he moved his reserves there, would Patton immediately cross the channel to the Pas-de-Calais? No, Hitler would wait to see if the attack was real. And so the days went by, with Rommel and Rundstedt fuming at his indecision. After several weeks, Hitler finally accepted that Normandy was the real destination. But by then he was too late. The Allies had established a beachhead. In August, they broke out of Normandy, sending the Germans into full retreat. To Hitler, the disaster was yet another indication of the incompetence of those around him. He had no idea how deeply and decisively he had been fooled. Interpretation. In trying to deceive Hitler about the Normandy invasions, the Allies were faced with a problem. Not only was the Führer suspicious and wary by nature, he knew of previous attempts to mislead him and knew that the Allies would have to try to deceive him again. How could the Allies possibly disguise the actual goal of a vast armada from a man who had reason to believe they would try to mislead him and was scrutinizing their every move? Fortunately, British intelligence had been able to provide the planners of the D-Day landings, including Prime Minister Winston Churchill, with information that would prove invaluable to them. First, they knew that Hitler was growing paranoid. He was isolated and overworked, his imagination overheated. He was prone to emotional outbursts, and he was suspicious of everyone and everything. Second, they knew of his belief that the Allies would try to invade the Balkans before France, and that the landing site in France would be in the Pas-de-Calais. He almost seemed to want these invasions to happen, as proof of his superior reasoning powers and foresight. Fooling Hitler into keeping his forces dispersed across Europe and France would give the Allies a slim margin of time in which to establish a beachhead. The key was to present him a picture composed of many different kinds of evidence that would tell him the Allies were doing just what he had thought they would. But this picture could not be made up of all kinds of flashing signs pointing to the Balkans and the Pas de Calais. That would reek of deception. Instead, they had to create something that had the weight and feel of reality. It had to be subtle, a mix of banal truths with little falsehoods stitched in. If Hitler saw that in its outlines it supported his expectations, his overactive mind would fill in the rest. This is how the Allies wove such a picture. By late 1943, the British had secretly identified all of the German agents active in England. The next step was to turn them into unwitting double agents by feeding them false information about Allied plans for an attack on the Balkans and Norway, say, and the massing of a fictional army commanded by Patton, the American general Hitler so feared, opposite the Pas de Calais. This army, FUSAG, existed only in piles of phony paperwork and wireless transmissions that mimicked a normal army. German agents were allowed to steal FUSAG documents and intercept transmissions, carefully misleading messages, but at the same time banal and bureaucratic ones, too banal to be seen as fake. Working with film designers, the Allies built an elaborate set of rubber, plastic, and wood that from German reconnaissance planes would look like an enormous camp of tents, airplanes, and tanks. The German general, who saw FUSAG with his own eyes, was misled about the direction he was taking toward London. He had actually passed the real army to the west of FUSAG's supposed site, massing for the invasion of Normandy. As the date of the invasion drew near, the Allies left clues combining fact and fiction still more intricately. The real time and place of the invasion were planted with an agent whom the Germans completely mistrusted, giving Hitler the feeling that he had seen through a deception, when in fact he was staring at the truth. Now, if real information on the timing of the invasion somehow leaked out, Hitler would not know what to believe. The Allies knew that reports on the buying up of Pas de Calais maps in Switzerland would reach Hitler, and this would have its own realistic logic. As for the Montgomery sightings in Gibraltar, little did the German agents know they were seeing a look-alike, a man trained to act like the general. In the end, the picture the Allies painted was so real to Hitler that well into July he believed in it, long after D-Day had actually happened. Through such subtle deceptions, they had compelled him to keep his forces dispersed, perhaps the decisive factor in the success of the invasion. In a competitive world, deception is a vital weapon that can give you a constant advantage. You can use it to distract your opponents, send them on goose chases, waste valuable time and resources in defending attacks that never come. But more than likely, your concept of deception is wrong. It does not entail elaborate illusions or all sorts of showy distractions. People are too sophisticated to fall for such things. Deception should mirror reality. It can be elaborate, as the British deception around D-Day was, but the effect should be of reality only subtly, slightly altered, not completely transformed. To mirror reality, you must understand its nature. Above all, reality is subjective. We filter events through our emotions and preconceptions, seeing what we want to see. Your false mirror must conform to people's desires and expectations, lulling them to sleep. If the Allies had wanted to attack the Pas de Calais, as Hitler suspected, and tried to convince Hitler the attack was coming to Normandy, that would have been a great deal harder than playing on his pre-existing belief. Your false mirror must incorporate things that are visibly true. It must seem somewhat banal, like life itself. It can have contradictory elements, as the D-Day deception did. Reality is often contradictory. In the end, like an Escher painting, you must blend truth and illusion to the point where they become indistinguishable, and your false mirror is taken for reality. By Julius Caesar. What we wish, we readily believe, and what we ourselves think, we imagine others think also. Keys to Warfare. In the early history of warfare, military leaders were faced with the following predicament. The success of any war effort depended on the ability to know as much about the other side, its intentions, its strengths and weaknesses, as possible. But the enemy would never willingly disclose this information. In addition, the enemy often came from an alien culture, with its peculiar ways of thinking and behaving. A general could not really know what was going on in the mind of the opposing general. From the outside, the enemy represented something of an impenetrable mystery. And yet, lacking some understanding of the other side, a general would be operating in the dark. The only solution was to scrutinize the enemy for outward signs of what was going on within. A strategist might count the cooking fires in the enemy camp, for example, and the changes in that number over time. That would show the army's size and whether it was increasing as reserves arrived or decreasing as it was split, or perhaps as soldiers deserted. To see where the army was heading or whether it was readying for battle, he would look for signs of movement or changes in its formation. He would try to get agents and spies to report on its activities from within. A leader who picked up enough of these signs and deciphered them correctly could piece together a reasonably clear picture. The leader also knew that just as he was watching the other side was doing the same with him. In pondering this back-and-forth game of reading appearances, certain enlightened strategists in cultures around the world had a similar epiphany. Why not deliberately distort the signs the enemy was looking at? Why not mislead by playing with appearances? If the enemy is counting our cooking fires, just as we are counting theirs, why not light more fires, or fewer, to create a false impression of our strength? If they are following our army's every move, why not move it in deceptive patterns, or send part of it in a direction as a decoy? If the enemy has sent spies and agents into our ranks, why not feed them false information? An enemy that thinks it knows our size and intentions, and is unaware that it has been misled, will act on its false knowledge and commit all kinds of mistakes. It will move its men to fight an enemy that is not there. It will fight with shadows. Thinking in this way, these ancient strategists created the art of organized deception, an art that would eventually filter beyond warfare into politics and society at large. In essence, military deception is about subtly manipulating and distorting signs of our identity and purpose to control the enemy's vision of reality and get them to act on their misperceptions. It is the art of managing appearances, and it can create a decisive advantage for whichever side uses it better. In war, where the stakes are so high, there is no moral taint in using deception. It is simply an added weapon to create an advantage, much as some animals use camouflage and other tricks to help them survive. To refuse this weapon is a form of unilateral disarmament, giving the other side a clearer view of the field, an advantage that can translate into victory, and there is no morality or goodness in losing a war. We face a similar dynamic in our daily battles in life. We are social creatures, and our happiness, even our survival, depends on our ability to understand what other people are intending and thinking. But because we cannot get inside their heads, we are forced to read the signs in their outward behavior. We ponder their past actions as indications of what they might do in the future. We examine their words, their looks, the tone in their voice, certain actions that seem laden with significance. Everything a person does in the social realm is a sign of some sort. At the same time, we are aware that 1,000 pairs of eyes are in turn watching us, reading us, and trying to sense our intentions. It is a never-ending battle over appearance and perception. If other people can read what we are up to, predict what we are going to do, while we have no clue about them, they have a constant advantage over us that they cannot help but exploit. That is why, in the social realm, we learn from an early age to use deception. We tell others what they want to hear, concealing our real thoughts, hedging with the truth, misleading to make a better impression. Many of these deceptions are entirely unconscious. Since appearances are critical, and deception is inevitable, What you want is to elevate your game, to make your deceptions more conscious and skillful. You need the power to cloak your maneuvers, to keep people off balance by controlling the perceptions they have of you and the signs you give out. In this sense, there is a lot you can learn from the military arts of deception, which are based on timeless laws of psychology and are infinitely applicable to the battles of daily life. To master this art, you must embrace its necessity and find creative pleasure in manipulating appearances, as if you were directing a film. The following are the six main forms of military deception, each with its own advantage. The false front. This is the oldest form of military deception. It originally involved making the enemy believe that one was weaker than in fact was the case. A leader would feign a retreat, say, baiting a trap for the enemy to rush into, luring it into an ambush. This was a favorite tactic of Sun Tzu's. The appearance of weakness often brings out people's aggressive side, making them drop strategy and prudence for an emotional and violent attack. When Napoleon found himself outnumbered and in a vulnerable strategic position before the Battle of Austerlitz, he deliberately showed signs of being panicked, indecisive, and scared. The enemy armies abandoned their strong position to attack him and rushed into a trap. It was his greatest victory. Controlling the front you present to the world is the most critical deceptive skill. People respond most directly to what they see, to what is most visible to their eyes. If you seem clever, if you seem deceptive, their guard will be up, and it will be impossible to mislead them. Instead, you need to present a front that does the opposite, disarms suspicions. The best front here is weakness, which will make the other side feel superior to you, so that they either ignore you, and being ignored is very valuable at times, or are baited into an aggressive action at the wrong moment. Once it is too late, once they are committed, they can find out the hard way that you are not so weak after all. In the battles of daily life, making people think they are better than you are, smarter, stronger, more competent, is often wise. It gives you breathing space to lay your plans, to manipulate. In a variation on this strategy, the front of virtue, honesty, and uprightness is often the perfect cover in a political world. These qualities may not seem weak, but serve the same function. They disarm people's suspicions. In that situation, though, it is important not to get caught doing something underhanded. Appearing as a hypocrite will set you far back in the deception game. In general, as strategists advocated in the days of ancient China, you should present a face to the world that promises the opposite of what you are actually planning. If you are getting ready to attack, seem unprepared for a fight, or too comfortable and relaxed to be plotting war. Appear calm and friendly. Doing this will help you gain control over your appearance and sharpen your ability to keep your opponents in the dark. The decoy attack. This is another ruse dating back to ancient times, and it remains perhaps the military's most common deceptive ploy. It began as a solution to a problem. If the enemy knew you were going to attack point A, they would put all their defenses there and make your job too difficult. But to deceive them on that score was not easy. Even if before battle you were able to disguise your intentions and fool them out of concentrating their forces at point A, the minute they actually saw your army headed there, they would rush to its defense. The only answer was to march your army toward point B. Or better, to send part of your army in that direction while holding troops in reserve for your real objective. The enemy would now have to move some or all of its army to defend point B. Do the same with points C and D, and the enemy would have to disperse all over the map. The key to this tactic is that instead of relying on words or rumors or planted information, the army really moves. It makes a concrete action. The enemy forces cannot afford to guess whether a deception is in the works. If they guess wrong, the consequences are disastrous. They have to move to cover point B, no matter what. It is, in any case, almost impossible to doubt the reality of actual troop movements, with all the time and energy those involve. So the decoy attack keeps the enemy dispersed and ignorant of your intentions, the ultimate dream of any general. The decoy attack is also a critical strategy in daily life, where you must retain the power to hide your intentions. To keep people from defending the points you want to attack, you must follow the military model and make real gestures toward a goal that does not interest you. You must seem to be investing time and energy to attack that point, as opposed to simply trying to signal the intention with words. Actions carry such weight and seem so real that people will naturally assume that is your real goal. Their attention is distracted from your actual objective. Their defenses are dispersed and weakened. Camouflage. The ability to blend into the environment is one of the most terrifying forms of military deception. In modern times, Asian armies have proven particularly adept in this art.